This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon is food psychologist Brian Wansink. He's interested in the environmental clues and cues that lead us to eat, lead us to what we eat, and how much we eat. He says we make at least 200 food decisions each day, most of them mindlessly. That sounds at least a little worrisome, doesn't it? Well, Wansink says we can make this work for us. He says the best diet is the one you don't know you're on. Brian Wansink is a fellow who loves food, by the way, from fancy to exotic to plain to drive-through. A former University of Illinois professor, he is the author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. The biographical thumbnail in the book and on its jacket says in part that Brian regularly enjoys French food and French fries. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon. Maybe you have a mindless story about eating to share with us. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Brian, our guest, is professor of marketing and nutritional science at Cornell University, where he directs the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think is his fourth book, the publisher, Bantam. And there's also a companion website, www.mindlesseating.org. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Brian, greetings from Urbana. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be back in Champaign-Urbana, as always.
Yeah, good to talk with you. 200 decisions about food every day. That's kind of mind-boggling.
Well, it's amazing. If you were to ask most people how many decisions they make about food a day, most people believe they make about 15 or 20. But what happens is that you can sit down for breakfast, and you're not just deciding between Cheerios and Wheaties, but you're deciding whether to pour two-thirds of a bowl or a full bowl or a second bowl. You're deciding skim milk, whole milk, a little bit of sugar, a lot of sugar, to whether you're going to have a Pop-Tart with it. And before a person even has their first bite of breakfast, they've made about 12 decisions.
Wow. How did you go about determining? How did you go about counting all of this?
Well, we actually did it a few different ways. The most labor-intensive way is we gave a bunch of those little stadium clickers to people, that when you go one, two, three, four, like that, gave them to them for a whole day and had them every time that they made a decision about food, whether it would be to eat a snack or to not eat a snack, whether it would be to walk up to a pop machine and buy something or not, they were to click it. And that's one way we did it. And then there are some other ways that we also did it, too. But what's so amazing is that until you're made aware of these things, you just automatically make decisions being influenced by everything around you. And that's what makes mindless eating so dangerous, is too often it's little cues around us that we're not even aware of. The lighting, the music, what the person's doing next to us, the size of a plate. These end up being the things that unknowingly bias these almost 200 decisions that we don't realize we're making.
Yeah. But you also say we can make this work in our favor.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to change your environment than to change your mind. And in one study, we actually did this throughout Bevere and Mumford Halls. We gave a number of office workers Hershey Kisses, a refillable Hershey Kiss bowl that we either put on their desk or just 6 feet from their desk. And every night we went back in and we counted how many they ate. And one of the things that we found is that if a candy dishes sitting on somebody's desk, they end up eating about 9 of these Hershey Kisses a day. If it's 6 feet away, they only end up eating 4. Now, it's a lot easier to just move a candy dish 6 feet than it is to remind yourself that you're very likely to eat it with it sitting on your desk.
Yeah, I remember reading about that back here when you were at Illinois, and since then I've emptied out the glass candy dish on my desk. It holds tea bags.
And very good. And we've taken it a step further. Besides moving the candy dish far away, we've bought opaque candy dishes. And then we filled them with candy that we don't like.
Well, the candy in the candy dish is, it's an opaque candy dish, but it's on top of a bookshelf, and it's out of the line of sight.
Excellent.
So it's, so we're doing pretty good on that count.
And so that's exactly what I mean when I say it's easier to just change your environment than it is to change your mind. Just making these small changes allow you to pretty much mindlessly eat the way you normally would, without being overwhelmingly tempted or without being overwhelmingly influenced negatively by your environment.
In the first chapter, you ask a big question. Why do we eat stuff that doesn't taste good? That's a great question.
Well, what's interesting is that if you ask people to think of the last time that they really overate, like to the point where they actually, regretted it, About 11% of the people would say it was an emotional time, like they're feeling down, there's a tough day at work. But 89% of the people would say the last time they really overate was because they were really, really hungry or because the food was really, really good. And in fact, we've done these studies that show that these are two of the last things that influence how much we eat. We went up to Mount Prospect. I took a number of graduate students up to Mount Prospect, Illinois, to a movie theater one time, and we wanted to show how just the size of a popcorn bucket would be a bigger determinant in how much somebody ate when compared to either the taste of the food or the how hungry people were. And so we took people who had just finished eating lunch, and we gave them one of those medium-sized popcorn buckets, or a huge bucket. And we filled it with 5-day-old popcorn. I mean, this is popcorn that, like, squeaked when you ate it. It's just terrible. So we have these people who, they're not hungry, they're given food that tastes bad, but we still found that throughout the course of the movie, people with the big buckets ate 35% more popcorn, even though they weren't hungry, even though it wasn't good. Simply all the cues around them told them to eat. The people next to them are eating, so they dutifully ate. The movie's rolling, and what do you do when you watch movies? Well, the script is you eat, so they dutifully ate. They've got a huge bucket. A huge bucket tells you it's appropriate, reasonable, typical, and normal to eat a lot, and they dutifully did so.
Yeah. Well, now tell us the story about the bottomless soup bowl. That's another one.
That's another UIUC classic. I did that with Professor Jim Payne, who's now at Eastern Illinois, and Jill North, who was then a graduate student. And we did it right there in the spice box on campus in Bevere Hall. And one of the things that we'd found out in a prior study is that if you asked 150 Parisians, people living in Paris, why it is they stop eating, how they know they're through eating dinner, they would say they know they're through eating dinner when they're no longer hungry or when the food no longer tastes good to them. Okay, those are internal cues that they're done. We'd ask the same questions to 150 Chicagoans who said they would know they were through eating dinner when the plate was empty, when everybody else was through eating at the dinner table, or when the TV show they were watching was over. Mm. Now, those are all external signals or external cues that the meal is over. Well, so we tested this in the spice box by saying, what would happen if a plate never emptied? Would people just keep on eating? Well, and what we did is we took some tables. We drilled holes in the bottom of soup bowls. We drilled holes through the tables. And we put this food-grade tubing from the bottom of the soup bowl down under the table and up into these big 6-quart soup colanders. And then we invited people in to eat soup. What would happen, though, is as people ate the soup, the level would go down a little bit. But the second they stopped eating, it would imperceptibly start to rise again. And so people could eat for days, and until they ate 6 quarts of soup, that bowl would never fully empty. Mm. And one of the things we found is that we stopped people after about 20 minutes, and they had eaten about 73% more soup than people who had been given normal bowls. But when asked how hungry they were, how full they were, they didn't rate themselves as any more full than the control group, because they said, how could I be full? I mean, I still have half a bowl of soup left.
Mm. There was a fellow who downed a quart before
it's
you
incredible.
Stopped him.
In that group we were using, there are also some college students, and college males can sometimes surprise you.
And bless them, they can afford it, can't they? They can afford
to put away a quart of tomato
mm. soup. Well, what does this mean for us what lesson might we take away from this when we go to the all-you-can-eat buffet?
Well, I mean, one lesson to take away from just the refillable soup bowls that we pretty much eat with our eyes and not with our stomach. Our stomach's like the last thing to tell us that we're full. And, you know, we know this when we eat in front of ice cream in front of the freezer. You know, you can take a couple spoonfuls and it doesn't look like you're even putting a dent in the thing. And then all of a sudden you look down a few spoonfuls later and it's almost empty. It's a whole lot better to dish something out into a dish, you know, to spoon something out into a dish, whether it be potato chips or whether it be ice cream or whatever, because at least then, for that 1 second, you know exactly how much you're going to eat. It's real hard to do it retrospectively, and that's why we tend to overeat out of bags and boxes, things like this. You mentioned the all-you-can-eat buffet. We've done a number of studies recently in all-you-can-eat buffets where we'd go. We did this in Illinois, in California, and then in New York. We'd go to all-you-can-eat Chinese buffets. And what we'd do is we would watch what people who were considered to be obese, that is a BMI of over 30, we'd watch how they kind of conducted themselves at the buffet. And then we'd look at normal weight people with BMIs of like under 25 and saw how they conducted themselves. And one of the things, actually the new version, the paperback version of Mindless Eating just came out, and we talk about this in the back of the book. But one of the things we find is that people who are obese, about 74% of them will sit facing the food. Okay? If we, you know, sit at a table where they face the food, if we take a look at the normal weight people, only about 30% will sit facing the food. The obese people end up sitting, on average, about 8 feet closer to the food than the less obese people. And whereas 26% of the Caucasian people with lower BMIs use chopsticks, only 7% of the obese people use chopsticks.
Hmm.
It's a whole convenience thing. If they're seeing food all the time, it's salient. It's convenient because they're sitting closer. It's convenient because you're using a fork and not, you know, those clumsy chopsticks.
Yeah.
All those things we know, in every study that's done, all contribute to overeating.
Yeah.
Convenience, salience.
What about the bargain part of it?
Yeah, that is Americans, like everybody else, just love bargains. We like to think we're getting our money when we do things. Well, one thing, we've done some things in a cafeteria, in an all-you-can-eat cafeteria somewhere else. And what we find is that when people have a meal card, that is, when you can eat at a place time and time and time again, there's a real tendency the first couple times you go, to just overeat to the point where you kind of hate yourself and everybody else. But after a very short period of time, there's an acclimation level that happens that people stop doing that. And I think part of what happens at these all-you-can-eat places is there's a it's kind of a kid in the candy store sort of mentality, but there's also a I better eat it or it's going to be gone mentality. And I think in some cases people want to eat a lot to get their money's worth too. We haven't conducted any studies specifically on that, though.
Yeah, I wonder, you've done some studies that might give you some clue as to mm-hmm. what's at work here. I'm thinking of, you know, how you describe and how you serve a chocolate brownie and what you can charge for it. But, for example, have you done any work in terms of if something is free, are people mm-hmm. apt to eat more than if they had to pay for it?
No, that's an interesting question. We know there's something that goes on that's called the endowment effect, that if you give people something, they feel that they take sort of a sense of ownership and possession of it. One thing that we've done in the past is we've given people a big plate of cookies and we tell them they're theirs, and then we say, oh my gosh, I made a mistake. I'm going to have to take those away because they actually belong in the other room. But let me check to make sure. Well, we go check to make sure, but all of a sudden they're at risk to losing their cookies. We end up finding that they end up eating about 40% more cookies very, very, very quickly than they do when they're not afraid of losing their free cookies.
Very devious.
that's a terrible one, yeah.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, food psychologist Brian Wansink. He is the author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, back to your deviousness. Let's talk about an evening at the Spice Box here at the University of Illinois. And you served some wine. And part of the dining room was told it was a lovely Cabernet Sauvignon from California, and the other half of the room was told it was from North Dakota, a lovely Cabernet from South Dakota.
North Dakota.
Even
colder,
further,
yeah. Well, one of the things that we are looking at in this case, and in reality, what it was a wine that's called Charles Shaw wine, which is, sells for $2 in some places, and it's affectionately known as Two Buck Chuck. What we'd done is we'd soaked the labels off those bottles and replaced it with these fake, realistic labels that said it was from California or North Dakota. Well, what this goes back to is we did a study. We know that if you change the label and you change a person's expectations, it has this tremendous influence on how they actually, their taste ratings. That if you think someone's going to be really, really, really bad, because actually, you know, North Dakota wine probably is pretty bad, you think, when you taste it, regardless of how good it is, you're going to rate it as worse than if you'd previously expected it to taste pretty good. But what we're interested in is how does this influence the rest of your meal? We know it makes, we know it biases you against the wine, but does it have this big, you know, halo effect on the rest of the food, or does it have a big shadow effect on the food if you think it's from North Dakota? So this is during a February, and you know, cold February, and when people came to their Spice Box meal, it's a prefix meal about $23, $24. We said, thanks for coming. Thanks for keeping your reservation. Because of that, we've got this complimentary glass of wine for you. And then we told them it was from either California. Other tables were told it was from North Dakota. And the bottle was plopped down right on the table after each glass was poured. And what we know, the people who thought they were drinking California wine, I mean, they ate more of their food. They spent about 15% longer lingering over their dinner. They ended up, when they left, they were more likely to make reservations to come back within the next 3 months. But if people were drinking what they thought was North Dakota wine, it just wasn't quite such a magical evening. They blasted through dinner. They left more plate waste. And when they asked if they wanted to come back, make reservations, come back, they would say things like, oh, you know, this is really a busy time of the year for me.
I'll have to check my book.
Yeah, this, well, and the thing is, this is really great news you can use, because how do most of us shop for wine? Well, most of us kind of, if we're going over a dinner party, we kind of go to buy wine. We say, well, I want to spend, whatever, $10 or whatever. Then we start looking at wine that's $10 that has the prettiest label. and to some extent, that's not a bad strategy.
Well, what does $2 Chuck taste like?
Well, you know, it's interesting that it not just varies year to year, but even it varies within a given year, because what they do is they take a lot of leftover grapes from a lot of different harvests, and they sort of gerrymander them together, so you get very unique taste. But it's not bad at all, and for that inexpensive, it is one of the better wine bargains.
Yeah.
And it won't poison you.
Yeah. So 1 year it's going to taste more like North Dakota, and 1 year it's going to taste more like Southern California or Northern California.
Or Mexico. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Well, the food issue of the New Yorker is out, and there's an article in there. It's very interesting. It's about wine con artists. And there's a line in the article that says, and these are people, the article is about people who love to collect and who love tasting, and I mean, these are people who have cellars and, you know, spend a lot of time and money collecting and enjoying wine. Well, there are a lot of con artists out there taking advantage of folks. And there's a line in the article that says the vast majority of fake wines are happily enjoyed. and some collectors don't want to know they've been had.
I'd believe that. We've gone to a wine auction at Sotheby's. They have in New York City. I think it's twice a year, and I think a lot of the people who are there buying wine at Sotheby's, even if it's terrible wine, probably enjoy it a whole lot more than if they would have bought it at Sam's Club.
Yeah. We have a listener who would like to talk with you, so let's take this call. Listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm enjoying the program, but I'm also beginning to wonder, if a person goes to the spice box, can they assume that they might be involved in an experiment?
Well, that's a good question. About 3 years ago, you could have been guaranteed you're going to be in an experiment. But since then, it's used more as a way to train people in fine dining. It ends up being sort of the capstone fine dining course. And now it's much more... You'll be asked to rate the food, but it's just, there's going to be no North Dakota wine. There's going to be no strange lighting going on. And there's not going to be nothing like that.
Well, okay. Thanks for your answer.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, 333-WILL, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What does all this tell us about what we're doing when we're eating in terms of how we are tasting or not tasting our food?
Well, so much of our eating behavior ends up being very patterned and almost on autopilot. And to some extent, it's good in some ways, because it allows us to parallel process and to multitask and to enjoy giving attention to the people we're with rather than, you know, staring at our gel and evaluating that. The downside, though, is that in this incredibly blessed life we have of plenty, we can very easily overeat quite a bit, and we can very easily enjoy food, you know, less than we might otherwise do so, because we're, you know, preoccupied with what else is going on. And that's kind of where the danger is. That's why we can mindlessly eat and enjoy it a whole lot less than we really probably should.
Hmm. Well, can the French teach us something there in terms of enjoying our food?
Yeah, like I'd mentioned, the study we did with 150 Parisians and 150 Chicagoans, and the Chicagoans say, hey, I know I'm through eating dinner when the TV show's over and my plate's empty. And the Parisians would say, I know I'm through eating dinner when, they actually said, when they're no longer hungry, when the food no longer tastes good, or when the food is cold. Now, that's interesting, because what it shows is that they really are sort of attending more to the food than to the circumstances around them. And that's something that's kind of nice to know. I had a person in my lab, this was when I was back at Illinois, who was taking a course on, I think it's like a meditation course, but she was telling us that for one of the exercises, they spent 45 minutes eating one pea, and that they were asked to sort of, you know, look at the pea and focus on it, and then describe it, and then, you know, cut a little piece off and taste it. And this is a 45-minute process to eat one pea. And I got quite a kick out of that, because that is uber mindfulness.
45 minutes, one pea.
Yeah, that's right. I thought to myself, I'm not keeping her busy enough if she's got that much spare time to eat a pea.
Yeah. It seems to me that part of this is also making our mealtime an occasion. What do you think?
That's a very good insight too. And if we look at a lot of cultures where there's a little less mindless eating, that's often what meals are. They're not seen as a means to an end, as I fear we often view them here. But they're often seen as an end to themselves, something that will stretch on for a couple hours. But a couple hours of sort of measured eating, not 20 minutes of like ravenous feeding, which, you know, we often see. I think there's probably a lot of cultural explanations why that exists. But what I find interesting is that, the book Mindless Eating is coming out in 14 different languages this year. And most of those are cultures that we wouldn't even think had a mindless eating problem. You know, cultures like, you know, Japan or Norway or Brazil or places like this. But what I found over and over again is that a typical person from, let's say, Taiwan or from France might be pretty good about not mindlessly overeating when they're in very patterned routine eating circumstances. But once you take them out and you put them in a lab, or once you take them out and you put them in a situation that's unfamiliar, they become as much a victim of their environment as your typical good-hearted American.
Mm.
It's just that in most of their situations, they're eating, a breakfast or lunch in a very patterned way. As their cultures become much more multitasking or much more sort of less patterned, I think we're going to see the same level of obesity pop up there as we have.
Yeah. I suspect that's why we get into trouble when we're eating in the car.
Yeah, we call that dashboard dining.
Yeah.
You know, we had an interesting situation with that a while back. I used to have a clinical psychologist who was in our lab, and we'd talk with some people on a regular basis. And one person had his only dietary downfall was he loved to eat fast food in the car every day on the way to work, every day on the way home from work. And in working with him, you don't want to say, don't ever do that, because that's not going to work.
No.
But we said, try this. For just a month, you can eat all the fast food you want to in your car, but you just cannot be driving when you do it. You have to pull over and park in the fast food parking lot or pull over at a rest stop, but you can eat wherever you want to, just not when you drive. And one of the things we saw him a month or 6 weeks later, and he says, this is incredible. He says, I'm no longer overeating. He says, because when I stop and eat the food without driving, I realized I didn't even really like it that much. It's just that when he was dodging traffic and weaving in and out of things, he was never able to focus on the flavor of the food, and so he kind of continued to overeat.
Yeah. And why a month?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of these things that we has been shown in a lot of clinical research is that if you want to break a pattern or if you want to establish a new pattern, what you need is 28 days of fairly consecutive behavior. So let's say a person wants to stop biting their fingernails. Well, if they cannot bite their fingernails, if they can do whatever's possible to not bite their fingernails for 28 days, after that point, it's going to be a new habit and a new routine behavior. With food issues, we find the same thing, that if somebody, let's say somebody has the habit of eating snack, a candy bar in the afternoon, we say, well, look, just go 28 days without doing that. And then after that point, if you want to go back to it, you can, but all you have to do is promise to do this a month. And what we find is that it's enough to break the script that caused that behavior. And it's also enough to kind of build a new script of this better, healthier behavior without them feeling put out.
Hmm. Well,
most people say, yeah, I can do it for a month. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Another listener in Champaign, line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
My observation in Chinese buffets is that and maybe you've tracked that, is that it seems to be an awful high percentage of people that are overweight. You know, that sometimes I'm waiting for somebody to meet somebody there, and all of a sudden I'm just watching the people that come in. And I don't know if you've ever done anything that wouldn't be, you know, you're looking at,
yeah,
you know, comparison and all, like, in terms of research, but it seems to be a fairly high percentage of people that already have a weight problem. The other one is that, as culture, what is it? The other one, in terms of when you eat with people, there's a tendency that you overeat. Is that correct? Rather than by yourself or not?
Yeah. They both are. In that case, what we find is that if a person eats by themselves, eats with one other person than by themselves, typically if they're eating lunch out, they'll end up eating about 30 to 35% more food. If they're eating dinner out and they're eating with six or more people, we find they eat closer to 90% more than they'd eat by themselves. And what happens is this. The more people you eat with, the longer you spend eating. And it's just like shopping. The longer you shop, the more money you spend. The longer you eat, the more food you eat. But the second thing that happens is you don't really want that experience to end, so you, because presumably you're eating with people you like, so you try to stretch it out and lengthen it. The other person wants to buy a dessert. You say, yeah, I'll get a dessert. The other person wants to have a coffee after that. You say, yeah, I'll have a latte after that. And so there's this attempt to make this good experience last, and generally that means eating more in the United States.
So in other words,
your first point about the Chinese buffet, one of the things that we find is that the percentage of really overweight people is much higher at dinner time than it is at lunchtime. At lunchtime, you'll find a much more, uniform distribution of normal weight people versus obese, whereas at nighttime, that gets very obese heavy, if you will.
So in other words, in terms of going out to eat, you go out to eat with people you don't like.
That's a solution. I guess eat by yourself in the closet all the time would be the other.
Coming out of the closet. Another one I understand, too, is that there's an interesting book about healing with whole foods and the idea of, eating, you know, better, eating better foods and all. But chewing, we don't tend to chew. I mean, we just sort of, and you were talking about what they taking a pee or some or other forever. But in terms of actually chewing, we don't get all the nutrients and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes we have a tendency to eat too fast, you know. But anyway, great program.
Oh, thanks. You know, we've started some things in chewing, but just, I mean, some of our results aren't that interesting. But one thing that we found as a sidebar is when we go to these all-you-can-eat buffets, we'll actually count the number of times people chew. What we'll do is we'll take 100 random bites that each person takes, you know, could be of whatever food, and we count the average number of chews. We find that the normal weight people end up the average number of times they chew their food, I think is 14 or 15. The heavier person ends up chewing it about 11. So it's there might be something to that, chewing your food more and eating less.
Yeah. I think people would be surprised if they took a look at the clock when they started and when they finished in terms of how rapidly they're eating or how slowly they're eating.
It is interesting. One of the things that we've been working with some people with using food diaries, and one of the things that we recommend if people are what we call speed eaters, and these are frequently males, but if they want to eat less, what we say is, look, be the last person to eat at the start eating at the table, and pace yourself with the slowest person. And it's really, really, really hard to do if you're 45 years old and been eating fast all your life. But we find that when people claim to be successful at it, we also see slight weight loss. Now, I mean, not, you know, a 30-pound weight loss in a month, but we see a slight weight loss when speed eaters are able to do that.
Mm. That's something that you argue for in the book is in terms of if you need to lose some weight, do it slowly, right? Don't, you know, what's the metaphor you use in terms of
mindless margin?
Yeah, that and you know, when you're going to if you're stuck without a bus, if your car is a flat and you've got to walk, you've got to get somewhere and you've got to walk it. Chances are, or you got to get there on foot. You're not going to run.
Yeah,
you're going to walk.
Yeah, and if you've got 2 miles to go, I mean, you know, you could run it, but it'd be painful, it'd be put out, you'd feel deprived. Or you could walk, and it'll take you 4 times longer, but you're probably even going to enjoy the experience.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hello. I'm a diet coach, and I actually quote your book all the time. I help people lose weight. We are reading it all the time. It's really got so many good insights in it. I have a dilemma with helping people try to leave food on their plate, not eating everything on their plate. And I try, you know, just like experiments, like could you just leave one bite of every plateful of food that you have for a week? And people can't do it. People can't do it. It's really that there's a big mind block against leaving food on your plate.
Waste not, want not.
Well, it is so difficult to do that. In fact, we used to try to get people to do that, and just even in experimental situations where they just know they have to do it for one meal, and we'd still find, you know, a third of the people couldn't even do it for one meal. One thing that some research that we've done in some other instances show that the average person will eat 92% of anything they serve themselves. So the problem is if it goes on your plate, it's probably going to get eaten.
Uh-huh.
So what we found most helpful is just to get people to put less on their plate to begin with. And it seems so doggone crazy, but just using these smaller plates and smaller bowls gets people to eat, serve a whole lot less. And as a result, they end up eating a whole lot less, even when they go back for seconds.
Right. So they have to consciously do it then.
Yeah, it's just a mindless way to eat less because, you know, 6 inches of, or rather 6 ounces of pasta in a 10-inch plate, it looks like a pretty decent serving, but that same 6 ounces on a 12.5-inch plate, which is what most of us have at home, I mean, it doesn't even look like an appetizer.
Right. Well, that's
so you have to put more on.
Yeah, that's why eating out, restaurant eating is so insidious with it, too, with the size of portion,
yeah.
Of course.
But it's somewhat, it's interesting. We've got a little demonstration video of this on mindlesseating.org, and I'm also one of the columnists and for the nutrition columnists for prevention.com, preventionmagazine.com, and they've got some really cool little demonstrations that they filmed up in the lab of what people do. So it's kind of motivating to see how it really trips people up.
The other thing I wanted to ask was, do you really think that it takes just 28 days to break a habit that is so ingrained as food is? It seems to me like some habits you could do that with, like flossing your teeth or something like that.
Yeah.
But it seems like, you know, we're almost hardwired to get our nurturing through food since we, you know, we've got it that way since birth. It just seems like that's an unrealistic expectation that sometimes people have that, oh, I should be able to do this because I've done it for 2 months. And then, you know, 4 months later, they're back doing the very same thing.
Yeah, because what usually happens in those cases is they're not trying to break one habit. They're trying to break 75 habits. But when I was talking about 28 days, it's 28 days of changing one single habit. And that one single habit would be to, let's say, drink diet cola instead of regular cola. Or one single habit could be to not eat a morning snack unless you have a piece of fruit before that snack. Mm. So I was talking about just small singular habits, small singular steps. Because when a person tries to wholesale change their life, it's just almost too dramatic for anybody to maintain. So that's why we look at just making small steps, small changes. And if you just make 3 100-calorie changes in your life every day, over the course of the year, that would add up to 30 pounds of weight that you would have saved. We've set something up. We have a tool called the National Mindless Eating Challenge. And it's about, I think, about 60,000 people that are a part of this challenge. And what they do is they go on, they answer a few questions, and based on those questions, we suggest to them 3 changes that are statistically most likely to be effective for them, to work. And then what happens is we give somebody a sheet, and every day they just check whether they've accomplished each of those 3 changes. You know, change might be don't serve family style, something like that. And every day they accomplish it, they do a check, and what we find is that helps keep a lot of people on track and helps them to lose the weight they want to in a less onerous way. And that's just mindlesseating.org is one of the portholes to that challenge.
Hmm. We've got a number of people waiting to talk with us and not very much time left. Let's go next to a listener in Clinton, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. A very interesting program. Just finished with my lunch, so this is very apropos. Just a couple of quick anecdotes here, and I'll hang up. I was raised on the south side of Chicago, and my parents grew up during the Depression, and food, nothing was left on the plate. It was almost a sin if you left the food on the plate. If you didn't clean your plate, oh, you must be sick. Go to bed. So that's the training there, but again, you know, they didn't have the abundance, and they just looked at it a different way. Fast forward several years later, I took them out to a fairly nice restaurant in Chicago for their anniversary, and they were incapable of enjoying themselves when they looked at the prices. And I tried to make overture, well, you know, Mom and Dad, it's a special event, so on and so forth, and they just could not equate the food. They just thought it was a highway robbery, and I suppose it's the way you're hardwired or where your upbringing comes from. But also, too, with the lady that called about the portions, I know whatever my wife puts on my plate, I'll eat. And if she gives me less, I'll eat it, and I won't be hungry. And if she gives me a lot, I'll eat it. So it's kind of like a Pavlovian dog, I suppose. But very interesting program. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we do find that the portion size can be adjusted about by 20% from what it normally is, and a person doesn't notice if it's 20% less or if it's 20% more. And they don't rate themselves as any hungrier or any more full. At the 25% less or 25% more, people notice it, though.
Yeah. So smaller plates, taller glasses.
That's right.
Right. Chopsticks.
Well, yeah. Move that candy dish. Serve family style. All these are little cues that can help a person eat a little less and like it a whole lot more. Yeah.
Maybe move to the dining room of all places.
Yeah, that's a radical concept, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much, Brian, for talking with us this afternoon.
Good
to talk with you again. And let's do it again at some point here in the not-too-distant future.
Absolutely. We're now looking a lot at children, so that could be a new topic for the future.
Yeah, that would be a great topic. Brian Wansick, author of Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. This is his fourth book, just now out in paperback, originally published in hardback not too long ago by Bantam. And there's a companion website that we've mentioned, www.mindlesseating.org. Our guest this afternoon, Brian Wansick, is a food psychologist. He's currently at Cornell, and he joined us there from Cornell this afternoon, and our thanks this afternoon to the technical director there in Ithaca, Don Battaccio. And what a great name that is. So thanks, guys.